Today's Taisho will be on case 40 in the Umenkwan, the Gate of No Barrier, the Mumonkan. Case 40 is entitled Tipping Over a Water Bottle. When Isan Osho was with Yakujo, he was Tenzo, or head cook, of the monastery. Yakujo wanted to choose a master for Mount Tai'i, so he called together all the monks and told them that anyone who could answer his question in an outstanding manner would be chosen. Then he took a water bottle and stood it on the floor and said, "You may not call this a water bottle. What do you call it?" The head monk said, "I cannot call it a stump." Yakujo asked Isan his opinion. Isan tipped over the water bottle with his feet and went out. Yakujo laughed and said, "The head monk loses." And Isan was named the founder of the new monastery. Mumon's comment. Isan displayed great spirit in his action, but he could not cut himself free from Yakujo's apron strings. He preferred the heavier task to the lighter one. Why was he like that, eh? He took off his headband and put on an iron yoke. Mumon's verse, tossing bamboo baskets and ladles away, he made a glorious dash and swept all before him. Yakujo's barrier cannot stop his advance. Thousands of Buddhas come forth from the tips of his feet. Somebody came up to me today and said, "Oh my God, I've just had the most incredible sit. Just wonderful this morning." Doesn't always happen, you know. It doesn't always happen. Sometimes you sit down on the cushion and your legs hurt, and your back hurts, and you're tired, and you know it's just a struggle, you know. But sometimes it's like the inside and the outside line up. And there's this incredible energy, this beautiful life energy. It's really marvelous, you know, really marvelous. You can't make it, you can't summon it at your will. You have to just make yourself available to this energy, which is ubiquitous and never ending. The problem is that we become closed up, and so we imagine that it's not present. So sometimes we let it go, and there it is. And we let our barriers go. We let our dreams and expectations go. We let our fears go and our compulsions go. And then we realize Hakuin Zenji said, we are like a person who is up to his neck in water complaining about being thirsty. And that is such a powerful account of a human being, right? We're in the midst of water and we feel that we're parched, right? Because of these obstacles that we have to overcome. And when we do, it's glorious. Everything becomes our rice. Just lean down and eat. Isan Osho was a student of Yakujo. He became Yakujo's student when he was 19 years old. And he studied with Yakujo until Yakujo died at 90. And at that time, Isan Osho, Osho means priest or monk, priest Isan was 43. So he studied with Yakujo for a long time. And at one time, he was the Tenzo, Tienzo, of a temple. He was in charge of cooking. Now, you know, you might think that being the cook is not a very prestigious job at a monastery. But actually, many great Zen masters have been cooks. Because, of course, cooking is a way of caring for everybody. It's an expression of your loving kindness. And naturally, if people don't have good food, it might be hard for them to practice if they're not getting nourishing food. And even though we say, when we recite the sutras, you know, we say, you know, I just eat this food for the, you know, to keep my body in good health. Nevertheless, I think it's important for the food to be good, you know, because it's inspiring, you know, it's inspiring. Sometimes I've been at Sesshin when I was training. We would have people who were Tenzo, and they were really terrible cooks, you know. And it would be like, my friend John Sunston was Tenzo at one time, and he is a terrible cook. Please don't quote me on that. But, you know, he would basically, every meal was rice, miso soup, and a vegetable. And it was just these very limp vegetables. The miso soup was just miso soup. And when he tried to spice it up, he cut up some sweet potato chunks and put it in the rice. And it was like breakfast, rice, miso soup, vegetable. Lunch, rice, miso soup, vegetable, you know. It was discouraging, you know. On the other hand, there were people in our Zen group who were really great cooks. And even if I were totally wiped out and I was totally exhausted, if I sat down and it would be like, oh, this is delicious. It was like my heart would leap up and I could do some more zazen. So I think having good cooking is important. Isan was at Tenzo, and he was in charge of making sure everybody got nourishing, healthy, delicious food. But he wasn't the head monk. So if you came to visit the temple, you would have said, well, who's really, other than the teacher, who's really in charge here? And they would have said, the head monk. So anyway, they're opening up a new temple on Mount Taiyi. And the master, teacher at the Hyakujo basically says, look, I want to make sure that the most qualified person runs this new temple, our new branch temple. And so I want to have a competition. It's interesting that he doesn't have a competition like this. He doesn't say, okay, all of you onto your cushions, and I want you to sit there, and I want to see how long you can sit. And I want to see who can sit the longest, you know. That he could have done that. He could have said, "Let's sit on our cushions and let's see who can sit the longest." Okay, on your mark, get set, go, you know. And then we could sit, you know, hour one. You know, he could turn the hourglass over, and you know, little by little, you know, people start sweating, grimacing, and the hours go by, and finally, you know, one person, uncrosses his legs and he's out, you know. And then the next person, you know, and you see a couple more. They finally crack, you know, and they you know, finally two people left, you know, and they're dueling it out. Neither one is moving, and it goes on. You know, they turn the clock again and again, you know, and finally, you know, you win, you know. Okay, you know, you get to run the new temple. It's not like that. And I think that's important. You know, it's important that that's not the competition. He doesn't say who can sit the longest, you know. What he does is very strange, you know. He takes a bottle, which is just this ordinary object, right? He takes a water bottle. I assume it's not a styrene water bottle or plastic. It must be ceramic, you know, since this is about the 7th century. And he puts it on the ground, and he said, now look, I want you to encounter this bottle, but I don't want you to encounter it through words and ideas, basically. So he says, took the water bottle and stood it on the floor, and he said, you may not call this a water bottle. What do you call it? See? The head monk says, you know, I wouldn't call it a stump. Now, what happens after that is Hyakucho asked Isan. Interestingly, Isan doesn't go, well, I can do better than that. You know, he's just sitting over there quietly, and he's invited to participate. And Isan gets up, and he tips over the water bottle with his feet. So he must sort of do a little jump and knock the water bottle out. And then he goes out. He walks out the door. And all of this takes place without a moment's reflection or hesitation. See, and Hyakucho is delighted. He bursts into laughter and he says, okay, the head monk loses. Isan was named as the founder of the new monastery. So basically, what happens in this little drama is that Hyakucho says, I want to see not just if you can enter deep mushin, but if you can act from that place in a dynamic manner. See, if you can act from that place in a dynamic manner, in a creative manner. And basically, the head monk is unable to really completely act from that place. He's still trapped in the world of ideas and language. He's still trapped in conventional thinking. And so he all he does is change the words around. He says, don't call it a water bottle. And he goes, okay, I wouldn't call it a stump. So this is like a kind of a clever answer. Years ago, I might have told you that there was a person I knew who told me that he had the answer to the sound of one hand clapping, and which is probably, in my experience, the most difficult koan there is. I don't know of any harder koan than that one. That one requires a fully actualized human being. You have to be capable of going into deep mushin, and then your whole body has to be alive with life energy in order to answer that koan. So it's the toughest koan I know. So this guy said, I think I've answered. You know, by the way, I hear you do Zen. And I said, yes, that's true. He said, you know, I think I've answered the sound of one hand clapping koan. Really? And I was interested. So, come over here, you know, someplace private. You know, he can show me. And he basically he opened and closed his hand very quickly, he can make a little clapping noise with his palm. You know? And I said, "That's it. You've done it." You know? No, I said, "I'm sorry. That's not the answer." I said, "I'm afraid that's not exactly the answer." But he had figured it out, see, in his mind. So that was like an intellectual answer, you know. That was like intellectual. He was very far from a totally actualized response that required the whole being, right? You know, yesterday I talked about how the practice of Zen involves the whole body-mind. And that our karmic obstructions can basically like enslave or block the whole body mind. So if you have had some kind of a trauma in your life, a friend of mine has a phobia. You know, his father tried to commit suicide. Basically, he came in and found his father on the floor, almost dead, and he called the hospital and they took his father to the hospital and his father didn't die. But anyway, my friend grew up in a home where there was a lot of unhappiness because his father was a novelist who wasn't able to be very successful at his chosen career. So he would, his wife would support the family, and this guy would stay at home and write these novels, and then he'd have a hard time getting them published. And even when they got published, they were neglected by critics, and so he felt like a failure, and finally tried to commit suicide. And my friend found his dad on the ground when he was a little boy. Anyway, my friend, as an adult, has all of this inside him. He hasn't worked any of this through. He's very, very compulsive about his work. He works very, very hard. He's extremely competitive because he doesn't want to be a failure like his dad, right? He probably hasn't thought about it that way, but it's so obvious to any outsider. And I think he's also trying to be a success so that he can rescue his dad. You know, in his mind, he's trying to save his father, who didn't succeed at what he wanted to do. So, you know, he has very complex psychology, but very simple, you know, human psychology. And anyway, my friend developed a phobia driving over bridges. He was taking his kids down to Assateague Island, to Chincoteague. And it's very pretty down there. If you ever go, I think it's a lovely way to spend a weekend. It's all swamps and ocean, and there's wild ponies out there. They're quite beautiful. You can see them, and the beaches are very pristine. It's quite beautiful. My friend used to take his family down there, but he was having some difficulties in his job, And basically, he was driving over this. There's a very long bridge. I think it's called the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. And it goes on forever. It's an interminable bridge. And you're over water, right? And water is, you know, just like you look to the right, water. Look to the left, water. And my friend, when he was driving over that bridge, began to, like, shake uncontrollably. And he couldn't continue to drive. You know, he felt like he was going to faint. And basically, he pulled over and had his wife drive. And when he's in situations like that, when he has to go over long bridges, he has this recurrent anxiety disorder. I recommended that my friend to go see a therapist, or he doesn't do Zazen. And so I really strongly recommended that he go to see a therapist. He didn't decide to do that. He's taking medication, but it doesn't really get to the heart of the problem. So anyway, this is, you know, when we hear a story like this, we may think it's unusual, but it's actually quite human. You know, we all develop we all carry this karma that creates blockages or blindnesses, you know. And little by little, our life energy can be closed up, you know. As I mentioned yesterday, a lot of people go through life feeling very tired all the time. You know, they get up, they go to their jobs, they get home. It's like they're just beat all the time, and you know. People can take lots of vitamins and so on and so on, and maybe they help, maybe they don't, but you know, sometimes they have a physical problem. You know, they go to the doctor and the doctor says you have anemia or something like that, but sometimes it's not really physical. It has to do with being blocked, you know. You're living the life you don't want to live, and you're wishing you were somewhere else. And yet you know you have to go to your job and so on and so on. And this can create these blockages, this feeling of being fatigued all the time. And indeed, this was a problem for my friend. You know, he would just drink huge amounts of coffee every day. He just had to keep, topping up with the caffeine. This is human. You know, as we go through life, we suffer these injuries, and we build little walls inside of ourselves to protect ourselves from things that have hurt us. And we screen them off and try to shut them out of our minds, But we spend a lot of energy trying to keep these doors closed, you know, and it wears us out after a while. So, Zen practice you could think of as gradually opening these doors that we've closed inside ourselves. And the beginning of that process is simply learning how to be calm, which is difficult for people. A lot of people don't know it, but they're like very agitated. And there's like a subtle undercurrent of nervousness or tension all the time. And people often try to relieve that tension by, say, drinking or other kinds of activities, drug use. Sometimes it's jogging. You know, you can go, if you jog every day, you can cut the stress level, and that's a healthy response. But it doesn't get to the heart of the problem. So, you know, little by little, we can open these doors, but the starting point is just learning how to be calm and safe, which is a huge achievement, actually. So when people do Zazen, they come into the Zendo, they sit down, and sometimes they begin to experience the cushion as like a safe place. You know, and some people have no other safe place in life, you know. You can sit down on the cushion, you watch your breath, and all of a sudden you feel the tension going away, and you begin to feel this sense of well-being and connectedness. And this is like very important. When you come to Sesshin, Sesshin is a little different process. You're sitting for 9 hours a day, and you become much more aware initially of your inner dynamics, you know. So at the end of day one of Sesshin, you may actually not feel very calm. You may feel agitated, or you may be just exhausted. But when you get up on day two, you'll notice, if you're fortunate, it might be day three in some cases, that there's like this deep sense of peace. You know, this deep sense of peace and safety and connectedness. And for some people, this sense of peace or safety and connectedness is like a long-lost friend. It's like, boy, it's been a while since I've known this. I think I was still in diapers, you know. And that is really a wonderful experience, right? That's the beginning of liberation. It's like, oh yes, I'm actually happy to be alive. You know, this is really just being alive is good. And then, you know, after we can enter this calm, safe, connected place, we begin to practice basically mu meditation or emptiness meditation. And emptiness meditation is like a great tool for working through our obstacles. You know, when you get to that safe, calm, connected place, that's actually called shamatha in Sanskrit. That's shamatha. In Pali, that was called samatha. But a shamatha is like that safe, calm, grounded, connected state. That's stage one in all Buddhist meditation practices, is that. And then we're going on to stage two, which is vipassana. So stage one is calming. In the Chinese East Asian tradition, this is called stopping. So first of all, stopping. It's like you come to Sesshin, you're on the treadmill, you're going 1,000 miles an hour, you come to Sesshin, you sit down on the cushion, and by day two, you're decompressing, you're in the moment, you're calm and stable. That's shamatha. And then step two is vipassana, or seeing, looking. And Vipassana is where we begin to observe things as they are in an unfrantic mind, right? In Zen, we do a special kind of Vipassana first, which is mu meditation, where we focus on emptiness, which is really a quality of the universe and a quality of our experience. And when we have become unified with emptiness, we can observe the world, observe events, and observe ourselves in a very revealing light, and we're gradually working through our obstacles until the barriers are gone and we can be active and spontaneous. But there are barriers, and we can't really necessarily be aware of them until they become a problem in our life. So, you know, my friend, the guy who has the problem driving over the water, I've talked to him. You know, he shared this with me, and I said, I think this must be related in some way to your father's trying to commit suicide. And my friend said, "Oh no, no, I'm over that." You know, it's like, I don't think so. but he said, "No, I'm over that." You know, so when he looks, he doesn't see anything. When he looks inside himself, he doesn't see any obstacles, but they're there. You know, so it takes a lot of practice in Zen to begin to encounter our inner obstacles, which we usually hide from ourselves. So a koan training is designed to help you find your obstacles and work through them. For example, there's a koan about a guy who's hanging from a branch by his teeth. And he can't let go, but if he opens his mouth to answer somebody's question, he'll fall into the Grand Canyon, basically. And when people have this koan for the first time, I say, okay, you're hanging from a branch over the Grand Canyon. Somebody asks you to say something to help them. If you open your mouth and help, you fall into the Grand Canyon. If you don't open your mouth, you're still dangling from the limb and you haven't helped somebody. What do you do? And basically, people think, oh, what a ridiculous koan, right? And they start meditating with this koan, but they may suddenly realize, oh my gosh, you know, there's an undercurrent of anxiety in my behavior all the time. See, now, they didn't see it before, but the koan helps them to see it. And if you sit with that anxiety, you can begin to see maybe some of its sources. And also, you can realize that this anxiety is something that can be transformed or gotten beyond, you know. So basically, there's an element. You know, Zen starts with calming, and then it goes to seeing or a vipassana practice, but it focuses on all things that are happening from moment to moment in the world and also in our own minds, okay, and eventually, it begins to undo all of these barriers, and it becomes possible to act in a more and more spontaneous way, Normally, we're trapped, you know, by all of these obstacles. And when we try to act, it's like we're dragging a bunch of chains behind us. It's like trying to run with chains on, you know. It's very hard. And one form that these obstacles can take is like chronic self-doubt, right? So many people are like have a very, very divided mind. Somebody might say to you, "Would you like an ice cream cone?" And you might think, "Do I? Do I want an ice? Should I eat an ice cream cone?" And you think, on the one hand, I would enjoy eating an ice cream cone, on the other hand, I know it's bad for me, you know. You think, you know, if I eat this ice cream cone, maybe I'll be a bad person. Or you think, what will other people think of me if they see me eating an ice cream cone? You know, this is very human, right? I mean, it's a kind of a trivial example, but often, when we have to make a choice, we split in two right away. You know, it's like you split in two right away. Yes, no. What do you want? Do you want to go to the party or not? Yes, no. And this means I'm not in touch. There's some kind of a barrier inside myself. So I think, should I go to the party? Do I want to go? I want to go to the party, but maybe I shouldn't. You know. And then you might think, well, you know, isn't that a waste of time? Shouldn't I be working? But if you work too much, you know, then you won't be effective in your job. And if you're not effective, you might lose your job. So, oh, I shouldn't go to the party because I could lose my job. You know, these kinds of thought processes, you know, and then you finally think, oh, I don't know what I want to do. I don't know if I want to go to the party or not. Right? This is, maybe this is just me, but I think this is very human, right? It becomes very difficult if somebody says, do you want to do this, for somebody to just say, yes! Say, yes! That's supposed to be an enthusiastic yes, right? Without a unified mind in accord with the way. Undivided yes. You know, do you want to be a painter? Well, I like to paint. I feel happy when I paint. But my father wants me to be a doctor. But I hate medicine. But I should be successful because my father has made so many sacrifices for me. You know, and then, okay, well, maybe I should go to medical school. Should I go to medical school? Should I be an artist? I don't know what I want. See, this is a common, this is somebody who's got a lot of barriers that haven't been worked through. And in other words, a human being, you know. When we sit down on the cushion, you know, we enter this calm place where we feel stable, and then we begin to enter emptiness, and then, you know, little by little, we're working through our barriers, and it becomes, you know, every once in a while, you feel like a little energy on the cushion. You know, it's like you're sitting on the cushion, you're not answering your koan, you're feeling totally crushed or something, or totally wiped out. Then all of a sudden you're sitting there and you feel like, oh, there's a little energy here. This is very nice. You know, I wonder why this is happening. You know, and little by little we start opening up these doors inside of ourselves, and we can begin to act with real spontaneity, real naturalness, right? Real naturalness. And eventually it's possible to be. You know, do you want an ice cream cone? Yes! Yes! You know, and you're just, you know, just 100% yes. You know, give me that ice cream cone. And you eat it, you know. If you ever have gone to a Chinese restaurant, you might have noticed that there is a big fat Buddha in the restaurant with a big belly, and his hands are in the air. And if you ask the restaurant people what it means, they have no clue, you know, because they're just in it for the money. You know. But the truth is that is actually a very profound symbol, you know, because that is a bodhisattva, a person who is no longer in a condition of self-doubt, and he is just joyously energetic. And if you look at him, he doesn't fit any of our expectations about a, you know. First of all, he's dumpy. You know, he's dumpy. He looks like a slob. You know, his robe is undone and his belly's hanging out over the cord. In ancient China, he would have been thought of as, you know, kind of a weird, basically a weird, you know. A weird fat old man, you know, and basically, you know, you might think, what kind of a religious symbol is that? You know? if you look at, you know, if you look at, say, Indian, you know, religious, all the gods have, you know, big biceps, and, you know, they're beautiful, and they're rippling with muscles.
That's not true.
Well, there is Ganesh, I admit, you know, he is, but a lot of them were very buff, as we said. And the saints are always very austere and thin, you know, very saintly looking, you know. This guy's just like kind of like a Slavovian, right, you know. But he's a natural man, right? He has no, he's not apologizing for anything. He's totally at ease in his skin, right? And so he's just, he's one with the Tao, right? And so this is like a really profound teaching of naturalness. And he's a fully actualized human being. You know, basically, that's a really profound. Next time you go into the restaurant, you can appreciate this. You know, that he's the one who can tip over the water bottle because he doesn't go, you know, I mean, we all get up in the morning and go, you know, oh, you know, whatever. I wish I looked a little different. You look in the mirror and say, oh, you know, I'm getting older. My hair is gray. You know what? You know, blah blah blah. Everybody does that. But every once in a while, we can get into a state of we can get into a natural state where we have energy and we're, you know, this is very important. You know, I think early Buddhism really was the Buddha never said. The Buddha said some interesting things about enlightenment. He said there's two different kinds of enlightenment. There's a kind of enlightenment in which everything disappears and it's totally still. And he said, but there's also a kind of enlightenment where you're walking around, you know. So there is an experience of enlightened mind which is absolutely still and absolutely unchanging. But there's also a dynamic element to this, which is this the creative or dynamic element of emptiness. And I think the early Buddhists focused too heavily on the purely static and unchanging character of enlightenment. And later Buddhists in the Mahayana came along and said, okay, it is true that when you're in deep mushin, there's an absolute stillness, absolute motionlessness. That's absolutely true. And it's an aspect of Buddha nature. It's an aspect of fundamental reality. But there's also this dynamic, energetic aspect as well. And the later Buddhists, the Mahayana people in the Zen and Tibetan tradition, criticized the early Buddhists and said, look, you guys are clinging to stillness. There's this other aspect, which is energy, the play of energy, you know, uninhibited energy. And so, yes, when we're sitting on the cushion, we have to focus our minds on the breath until we become stable and calm. And there's a beautiful peace and joy that arises in that state. But that's just one side, one aspect. The other aspect is that there's this pulsing energy coming out of that emptiness at all times. And we have to unify ourselves with that energy. And we have all kinds of fears about it, right? We can have fears about the emptiness too. But more typically, people have fears about unifying with the energy. The energy arises and it's beautiful, but we might really accomplished people can enter deep samadhi on the cushion, but they can also enter a kind of samadhi in the world of form, where they're moving through the chaos and the craziness, and they're instead of resisting it. They're riding the waves. They're going with it. You know, I didn't realize this. I have paid no attention to the world of computers except I own one. And I have never been like a Mac fan, right? All my life I keep running into these people who are like, they have a religion called Mac. And it's like my father-in-law, he would only work with Macs. He said, oh, I only work with Macs, you know, and he was a graphic designer, so I understand they have good graphic programs. And but his Macs were like, it was like the highest technology was the Mac, you know. And my friends at work, they all have Macs, and I have a Dell. And they just can't. It's like, what's wrong with you? You know, why do you have a Dell? You know, the Mac, you know, the iMac. Anyway, I'm not really crazy about Macs. So anyway, I was reading this article about Steve Jobs, and I had no idea. You know, Steve Jobs was adopted, and he was an orphan. He was given up for adoption, and it's an incredible story. But the thing is, when he was about 18 or 19, he quit school, and he actually used drugs. He used LSD and some other psychedelic drugs, and he became fascinated by Buddhism, and he went to Japan and he sat in a Zen monastery. And I saw a picture in a magazine about him, and he's sitting. He held the first Mac that was ever made. They were small, unlike the regular tower, you know, the big towers that go with other computers. He had this little portable box that was the Mac. And it's a picture of him in, like, Time magazine. And he's sitting full lotus, in a very good full lotus, if I may say so. And he's holding the Mac in his lap. And I haven't had a chance to really study this, but I think Steve Jobs really learned something in that temple in Japan. You know, because he's an incredibly creative guy, you know. I think he learned how to use the active side of Mushin, you know, to be really active and creative. It's like because of our obstacles and our karma, you know, as things are unfolding around us, we can find ourselves becoming fearful. It's like we're losing control. I'm losing control. I'm losing control. It's all going to spin out of control. And I struggle with this myself, you know. But when we're, when, you know, there's a way of skillfully negotiating the events as they unfold, you know, not consciously. You're not trying to control. You're going with. So it's like normally, you know, when things start to become uncontrollable, we withdraw, we contract, or we step back. And you can feel yourself pulling back, pulling back. And creating a distance. And then that actually only intensifies one's sense of helplessness. But there's another way of interacting with events as they unfold, where instead of pulling back, you're going to meet them. It's like you make it's like kind of a mental practice of becoming one with the situation. So as soon as you feel yourself withdrawing or pulling back, it's like contracting, you know you're distancing yourself. When things are unfolding, you want to go forward into the moment as it's unfolding. This is just like watching your breath, by the way. You know, when you watch your breath, you want to become one with the breath, right? You want to become one with the breath, and you ride the breath forward. But this is true for events, too. You become one with the events, and you ride the breath, you ride the moment forward. See, you just keep going forward with the moment. And you make a practice of not hesitating, not withdrawing. This is very difficult, but it's quite doable. You know, I have done this many times myself. You know, when I first came to my job at Rutgers, the place was in great disarray, and the person who had my job was a very disorganized guy, it just seemed like every day there was an emergency. You know, it was like because things were so poorly organized, things were always falling apart, and everybody was rushing around trying to put out this fire and then this fire, and nobody had time to sort of like organize everything. And I had just gotten to Rutgers, and I had been, you know, just coming off of about 10 years of Zen training. Basically, I think my training worked really beautifully because I just kept embracing what was happening and going with the unfolding of the event. And people said to me, "How come you're so calm? How can you do this? You know, you seem so calm." You know, I think it was just my Zen training really prepared me for being with whatever is happening as Buddha. You know, it's like everything that is happening is Buddha. So I'm going to be with this moment now without any kind of condition. And I didn't consciously try it, but I just think I was just riding the waves, you know. And I think somebody like Steve Jobs was really very adept at this. I think that he made a practice of being one with the moment, you know, in a way that made him very creative. I think he's an exceptional person, but I think he learned something really important in Japan about Zen practice. You know, as I say, Zen is not just about being calm on the cushion and entering a peaceful state on the cushion. It's about being the other side of that energy. The other side of Mu is this action. So, you know, part of Zen practice is cleaning the dishes, you know, wiping the floor, and it's not like a substitute for practice. It's you, when you go about these activities, you know, you want to try to be riding the wave of the moment as you're doing them, you know. And generally speaking, this produces a sense of energy or happiness or joy, you know. In its simplest form. The simplest form of this is calling Mu, right? I'll wrap it up. But when people are coming to the Dokusan room, you know, they're often experiencing Zen in the form of this immobility, unchanging emptiness, you know, and it's absolutely like this unchanging, immobile emptiness that's just eternal, always there, and that's real. That's real. But, you know, now you have to call Mu, and moving from that stillness into action can seem very difficult. As soon as we try to call Mu again, we become self-conscious, we become self-critical, all our karma kicks in, right? You think, oh, I can never do this, you know, oh, what, that was terrible, ah, you know, and so on. But little by little, you know, people finally just give up and let there's no such thing as a bad Mu. You know, so you can call Mu with a big voice or a little voice. The point is not to make a good impression. The point is to be one with the activity and to ride the wave of the moment as it unfolds, wherever it goes, you know. Generally speaking, it's a very, that's a really beautiful way to be. When Isan Osho was with Hyakujo, he was Tenzo, or head cook, of the monastery. Hyakujo wanted to choose a master for Mount Tai-i, so he called together all the monks and told them that anyone who could answer his question in an outstanding manner would be chosen. Then he took a water bottle and stood it on the floor and said, "You may not call this a water bottle. What would you call it?" The head monk said, "It cannot be called a stump." Hyakujo asked Isan his opinion. Isan tipped over the water bottle with his feet and he went out. See, he's the Steve Jobs of that monastery. Hyakujo laughed and said, "The head monk loses." Now, let me just say, in reality, there's no winning and losing. That was really what was worrying the head monk. See, what was worrying the head monk was the thought he might not do it right. And that was so inhibiting that he couldn't respond spontaneously. If he had just gone with the moment, any answer would have been good. You know, actually, anything he did would have been good. You know, he could have thrown it out the window. He could have, you know, thrown it at his teacher. He could have lay down and put it on his stomach. Actually, he could, you know, pretend to drink out of it. Any of those answers would have been acceptable. In reality, there's no unacceptable. Okay. The head monk loses, and Isam was named founder of the new monastery. Mumon's comment: Isam displayed great spirit in his action, but he could not cut himself free from Hyakucho's apron strings. Remember, that's a compliment. Whenever Mumon runs somebody down, he's paying a compliment. So he's really saying, Isam did a great job. He preferred the heavier task to the lighter one. Why was he like that, huh? He took off his headband to bear an iron yoke. In other words, Isam is, once you can ride the waves, you're not going to pull back because you're afraid, so you can take on challenges. You aren't afraid of as soon as you're afraid of losing, you know, you've already lost, right? That's I mean, we all have that fear, but as soon as you're afraid of losing, you've already lost. You're already pulling back. So if you just say, I'm going to ride the wave of the moment, I'm going to be with the moment as it unfolds, unconditionally, see, then, you know, basically you can take on any challenge. Because you're responding in a lively, unified mind. Okay. Mumon's verse: tossing bamboo caskets and ladles away, he made a glorious dash and swept all before him. Hyakujo's barrier cannot stop his advance. Thousands of Buddhas come forth from the tips of his feet. See, that's like every part of his body is energized. See, that's a fully realized bodhisattva. So anyway, this is like a school for fully realized bodhisattvas, and we're all practicing, and it's a beautiful way to spend a day, to spend a week, or spend a lifetime. So please keep up the good work.